bit weird for me because I teach in this room, and I hope you'll be as attentive and intelligent as the students I teach, or at least stay away. That'd be nice. For those of you who weren't in earlier, my name's Charlie Beckett. I'm professor here at the Department of Media and Communications, and I run POLIS, which is the think tank on this conference. And welcome to this film screening. Just a very quick explanation about how this film came about. It's all down to a student colleague of mine, Joelle E., who had the idea of making this movie. And if I got it right, it was originally, Joelle actually worked in refugee camps in Lebanon. She's from there herself, and is very interested in it academically, about how that story has been covered, and what it tells us about news media, and what news media can do. And she had a really good idea, which is always a good idea, to go and talk to journalists who have been covering the crisis, people like Karim Shaheen here, who in the last session you heard speak, the Guardian's correspondent in Lebanon. And so she had this idea about interviewing people, and I can't remember, was it your idea to make a film about it, or was that my idea?
I think you both pitched in.
Yes, let's do that. Because I used to work in television, and I used to make films. And anyway, Joelle, you can judge yourself, but just to explain the sort of purpose of this, is not a film about the refugee crisis. It is about the journalists based in Beirut, how they have tried to cover that story, which is obviously where it originated and where it continues. So it's very much their reflections upon their craft and the challenges and opportunities they face. So it's not about the refugee crisis, it's about how journalists feel about the way they covered it. And Joelle managed to talk to a fascinating group of journalists out there, and indeed put the whole film together with colleagues out in Lebanon as well. So we'll play the film, and then we'll have a chat with Joelle and Karim about some of the issues it raises, and I'd love to get your feedback as well about what you think of the movie. But first, let's play the movie.
What do you think? About the film? For Christ's sake, tell us. Go on, at the back.
Hi, I'm Jayla. Thank you. It was definitely because I'm Lebanese and living through this, and it's very intense, the whole situation with refugees. One of the things that struck me when I was watching this documentary, because I actually worked with refugees at one point, and I had to go into my village and go looking for them. I have a feeling a lot of the time when the media is covering refugee issues, they're covering the gatherings and the camps and places that are known to the media that they are there. But some of the most difficult and really tragic stories are in the remote villages and places where they don't even have like 5,000 euros to go down to Beirut to register with the UNHCR. These are completely not really getting, I think, the exposure that they need. So yeah, I'm wondering if there's more efforts to go into these remote areas. And one thing I really wanted to say was, I'm feeling a little bit of a disconnect in the sense that when you're covering the refugee issues in Europe, it's not the same as Lebanon. But what they're doing is they cover the suffering without the context around them. Yeah, and what would be great is to have, for example, when you're covering the refugees, it would be good to cover the people around them and the environment. What are they thinking? How are they feeling? Because my experience with them is a lot of the trauma and the suffering is not only the poverty, but the hostility with their host environment. So if you would recommend any documentaries or if you know about any initiatives, and I would really like to know if this is available online so that I can share it.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said that we're going to be putting this online and showing it endlessly, I hope, actually. Joelle, would you like to talk to that first, though, partly to explain what you did before when you were actually working out there and how you've then, partly, I suppose, by the film, but just more by your work and then being here thinking about media?
First of all, thank you for your question. And allow me to thank you all for coming. A huge thanks for Karim for flying from Beirut to be with us today. Taking a break from the garbage crisis in Beirut. Fresh air in London is, I'm sure, entertaining.
And used to the amount of oxygen in the air.
This small project is really quite a last-minute spontaneous project that came out of me asking a million questions and bombarding Charlie, because he's my professor, with these questions. And I've been covering the Syria crisis from the humanitarian side since the start now. And I used to do refugee protection, and I moved into communications around 2013, just at this, around the same time when Karim actually started covering the crisis from inside Lebanon. And I haven't, up until I came to LSE, up until I came to London, I haven't really paused and reflected on what was really going on over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. And I did communications. I was a spokesperson for two agencies, first UNHCR, and then I moved to the World Food Programme. And basically my first point of contact was journalists. And I was in a way performing a lot of journalistic tasks, because my main task was to tell one story instead of a million, like you, which is the refugee story. And I spent all day brainstorming and trying to see how can I push this story further. And up until I came here is when I started asking these questions about, like, why do we cover this story and not the other? Why do we wait for an incident or a UNHCR press release that says 1 million refugees are now registered in Lebanon or in Jordan, for example, to cover the story? And I came here at the time when the story in Europe sparked. So the questions now became, okay, why is it sparking now? I mean, there are many children, many people who are dying, trying to cross the Mediterranean, reaching Europe before. Why is the story, you know, sort of peaked now? And so all of these questions made me sit down and go back to the same people who used to call us and pester you with questions. So I went to Beirut over Christmas, and I had a few days to put this together, and I'm really excited about having this discussion with you. Oh yes, on that note, I can tell you from doing communications from the humanitarian, from a humanitarian perspective, right? This crisis is so visual. That's why you see a lot of it online, as opposed to other, you know, crises in other parts of the world. And in Lebanon, one thing we mentioned before, the government does not allow formal camps, and so refugees, like you said, the most refugees are, you know, living in normal apartments or, you know, in urban settings. In Jordan, for example, when we get journalists, they only want to go see Za'atari refugee camp, even though over 70% of refugees are actually living in the city in really, really, really underdeveloped and poor dwellings. So I think this question is for Karim, but this is an observation that we do notice and we try to deal with when we sort of do our reporting and we work on our videos and our photos and when we pitch stories to journalists in hope that they would write about it.
On your question about host communities, I mean, I think it's really important and you know, Lebanon, you know, we said at the session earlier that Lebanon is hosting, you know, over 1 million refugees for a population of 4 million that was, you know, before the war. So it's the equivalent of the UK having, you know, over 20 million refugees all of a sudden. That the UK has to deal with and handle. And you're right, you know, there isn't that much coverage of what it's doing to Lebanon, of how much of the infrastructure has collapsed as a consequence, how many people have been plunged into poverty because they have to compete for jobs, you know, just how bad the situation in the country is. I mean, there's a major political crisis, there's been no president for 2 years. There's so many different elements to the you know, the problems that are facing, you know, local host communities. On the other hand, you know, we've tried to do a bit of that. I mean, I did a story, I think, that came out last month about all the Lebanese who were, you know, due to poverty and due to political stagnation and corruption, have actually been forging Syrian passports and trying to get on the migrant trail, you know, and traveling to, you know, to Europe after getting fake passports from Turkey and, you know, and leaving the country. And this is especially the case in like the more poverty-stricken areas in the north, like Tripoli and so on. We've tried to cover that and to incorporate that into our coverage of the political crisis in Lebanon that's, you know, never seems to end. But you're right, there is definitely scope for more coverage of the the situation of the host communities and the growing hostility, because this is a crisis that's been going on for 4 or 5 years. You know, there's before that, obviously, there was a Syrian occupation of Lebanon, and so there are latent tensions, you know, that have been going on for a long time. So there are definitely a lot of different aspects that need to be covered more.
I think one of the things that interests me about refugee culture.
Sorry, do you mind just saying Ewa?
Yeah, my name is Desmond. Do you want me to say
anything else? Favorite football team.
I have nothing to do with the LSC.
Most people here don't.
I used to be a journalist, but I haven't been for a long time. So what I was, and I have this to the level quite long. So what I was going to say is that one of the things about, first of all, I would like to have seen the film put into context the other refugee crises in Lebanon, which of course have been a lot. I know it's a lot to do with tensions, but it's kind of interesting. I've been found interesting. And the other thing I wanted to say is I wanted to comment on education, because one of the real problems, I mean, there are many problems of being a refugee, but one of the enduring problems is that the children just don't get educated to any extent. But in Lebanon, I have seen some attempts in kind of out-of-the-way villages and towns where the Lebanese children go to school in the morning and the Syrian children go to school in the afternoon. And this, to me, is a wonderfully positive aspect of what the host community could or can do in terms of refugees. And I would really like to have seen it emphasized.
On the education issue, obviously I would have loved to discuss every single aspect of the crisis that, you know, we're living every day. It's interesting to point out that the education system in Lebanon has been quite remarkable in the way they've tried to cope with it, but at the same time, of course, the majority of Syrian children are not going to school, even though this is a solution for those who are registered in schools, and though the private initiatives that are in place now and could be in place are perhaps the only hope in trying to get more Syrian children in school. This is on just the education issue, but maybe Karim wants to.
Yes, so I mean, I covered the education issue quite extensively in Lebanon, and there's, I mean, as you mentioned, there are various different initiatives to try and incorporate them into the school system. There are volunteer schools that are set up. There are schools that try to get some sort of accreditation so that these degrees would, you know, count towards something towards the end. UNICEF has set up, a number of tent schools, so you can only build tent schools because you can't build permanent structures because Lebanese government doesn't want you to. So you can't actually have concrete on the floor, so you have to have these tent schools in the various camps. But we've also written a lot about, the alternatives, like what do these kids do if they're not in school? And, I went, spent a day with refugee kids who were working actually right next to a cannabis field in the Bekaa Valley, and you know, and that's a big part of what they do. You know, they need to actually make some sort of money because the parents can't work, and so you know, they work for like 8 hours tilling fields, and for the equivalent of about $7, per day for 8 hours of really backbreaking work for kids who are 8 to 10 years old. We also did a story on street kids. If you live in Beirut, it's something that's with you every day. You know, you go out to have a drink in the evening, and children are coming up to you to either beg for money. Women are sleeping in the street with their infants. Every time you come down with like a falafel sandwich from busy street in Lebanon, you're passing by a woman sleeping literally in the street with her four kids, and So it's not something that you really can, you know, turn a blind eye to. So, and these kids aren't going to school. You know, they're spending the day shining shoes and selling flowers, and you know, and instead they're being exploited. And so the highest paying job for a street kid in Lebanon is prostitution. I think it pays $12 an hour as opposed to shining shoes, which pays $3 an hour. And you know, that's a really key story to tell too. So when they're not in school, they're subject to all forms of exploitation.
Anybody else? What sort of political discourses are happening sort of within Lebanon? Because a lot of the coverage is about rightly about the refugees themselves, but there must be an awful lot of political toing and froing within the country about what to do about the crisis. And I mean, you mentioned one thing the government is very staunch on is that it's not going to become a permanent thing. But I mean, how is that discussion within the country evolving, and how does that affect the refugees themselves?
The government doesn't want refugees to have a permanent presence. You know, they built refugee camps for the Palestinians after the 48 war. And there's still 467,000 Palestinians living in Lebanon, you know, with no prospect of ever going back. And actually their numbers have added because of the Palestinians who fled Syria as well. You know, so in 2012, when the Yarmouk camp, which is the biggest Palestinian refugee camp in Syria, which is actually like a big bustling neighborhood with a million people, you know, when that camp was bombed by the government, a lot of these people fled to Lebanon to live with people who, you know, were extended family members or people from the same village or city. And, you know, the result was like, you know, Burj al-Barajni, which is a camp in South Beirut, you know, it's 1 square kilometer and had 20,000 people, you know, became 40,000 people. You can't actually see the sun when you're walking in the camp because of how many new floors have been added to already derelict buildings, you know. But you're right. I mean, there isn't... initially, the issue was how to incorporate so many people into the country, especially given Lebanon has very particulars when it comes to, you know, balancing the powers of the different sects in the country. It's 4 million people with 18 officially recognized sects, and you know, the prime minister has to be Sunni, president Christian, the speaker of parliament has to be a Shia, and so there was concern among you know, the people running the country that you have an influx of 1 million mostly Sunni refugees, you know. So that was like the demographic issue was a key issue for Lebanon. Actually, I mean, you know, many of the concerns now are not that dissimilar to the narrative in Europe, except it's an actual problem. you know, I mean, there's like one out of five people you meet in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee, you know, so it's a genuine demographic change, you know. As opposed to, like, you know, if 20,000 Syrians come into Britain, you know, it's not going to be a huge... I mean, anyway, like, from our perspective, like, if you're looking at it from someone who's living in Lebanon, you know. So that, like, the same discussion is also happening in places like Lebanon. Turkey has 2 million refugees, which is more than Lebanon, but it, obviously it's a much bigger country with vastly more resources and a much bigger population. So the issue of, like, demographics is not really a huge problem. And, you know, when you ask most Syrians in Lebanon, like, what do you want? They want to go back home, you know, and they just don't want to go back home to war and to indiscriminate aerial bombardment, you know. And so that's the discussion is very similar to what's happening in, to the discussion that's happening in Europe, you know, with the various elements. You know, obviously a lot of people are very welcoming. Some people are, you know, disliking or discriminatory, you know. They're worried about demographics. They're worried about jobs. They're worried about all these various things. In addition, obviously, to the particularities of the fact that Lebanon is right next door to Syria, and Hezbollah, which is the party and the military organization in Lebanon, is fighting in Syria, you know, alongside the government. So there have been a number of suicide bombings in Lebanon in retaliation for Hezbollah's involvement. So. Obviously, there's like a much stronger, security and political aspect to the debate as well.
Just a quick question. As a journalist, what are the risks you face reporting such stories like
Yeah, I mean, you know, Lebanon doesn't really have a state, so it's, you know, there's nobody really to censor you. I mean, it's not a huge, you know, it's not a huge concern for us. Lebanon enjoys like one of the most, vibrant, partisan media environment, but also very, very vibrant. You know, there are many news channels. They're not afraid to tackle issues like corruption and terrorism and things like that. So. They speak very freely about all these issues, and I've never had to, like, you never really have to get special permission to go to the Qa'a Valley and to interview refugees and so on. Sometimes if you're taking camera equipment to like more sensitive sites, that's an issue you need to be aware of. Certainly, I mean the coverage of like the tensions along the border regions, because Lebanon has like a massive border with Syria. And there have been occasional incursions by, you know, extremist groups, flowing across the border and attacking Lebanese towns and villages. It was a relatively minor risk. You know, it wasn't a huge problem.
Do you need to take permission from, like, the Ministry of Information or Ministry of...
To do what?
To go and film.
If you're going to film in like sensitive sites, you know, areas controlled by Hezbollah in particular, you need permission from them.
Only refugees.
No, refugees. No, you don't need permission. generally, most journalists carry accreditation and press cards and stuff, and so you need to show that if you're going to an area. Yeah, because there are lots of checkpoints, you know, along the roads to the Qa'a Valley. So you generally, you need to have the accreditation to get through there. But if you're filming across the border, you usually need like. Especially in areas where Hezbollah is primarily in charge of protecting those areas, for example, you need to get permission from them. You need to talk to them and get them to approve that. And they kind of they have like a media office and with business cards and everything.
How often do you post a story or put forward a story to the media organizations that you work with that doesn't actually get carried? So what's the proportion of news that you think is interesting and relevant that actually simply they consider not to be newsworthy?
Right. So I'll answer this without getting fired. In all fairness, my experience with The Guardian, anyway, has been that they recognize that those journalists who are actually based, in the area, have good judgment, and they trust their judgment when it comes to saying this is a worthy story of writing about, this is not that important. Obviously, there are stories that, I'll have to do because it's, I wouldn't care as much for it, but, I kind of have to do because it's, there, or the last couple of weeks we've been. I've had to repeatedly write about this case, this bizarre case of Australian journalists who went to Lebanon and tried to kidnap this is a weird like family custody case, which was extremely frustrating to try and to have to work on, so there's always that, but they actually tell us we don't want you just. We know that the region is not guns and bullets only. And so, we want you to pitch those stories that, tell, inspirational human interest stories that go beyond, talking about what Russia is up to in the Middle East, or, the latest canceled U.S. program to train rebels or something, or the latest developments on the ground. They want us to have, like, a bird's-eye view of what's going on. They want us to have, an eye for genuinely strategic developments. But they also really want, the human element in the stories, and they want us to push for them and to pitch them. Very few stories that I've said, let's do this, and they're like, no, it sounds stupid.
I can tell you that for the majority of people who are now classified as refugees or vulnerable people or people who need our help, for them, the biggest issue in their lives right now is not just how to get a British passport or an Italian passport. It's really access to water. It's whether they can, a woman, whether she can register in the afternoon program to learn how to sue, for example, or whether the municipality and UNHCR and UNDP were able to, you know, dig a water hole so that the informal camp can get some water. So for them, those are the issues. Those are the day-to-day issues that if you go to a refugee camp, they're not going to come and say, oh, let me tell you about what's happening in Syria. Let's talk about the political stuff. They're going to say, you know, we need water. We don't have water. We don't have, you know, a proper sewage system. And organizations try to push these. We were talking yesterday about the million emails we send out to journalists. This is really what's going on, and this is what the refugees want to talk about.
I don't care that Angelina Jolie went to a refugee camp.
The Prime Minister of Lebanon does. So those are really like the day-to-day stories that don't get out there because they don't really sell. And at the same time, this speaks to the limitations of our work, both on my end as spokesperson or someone who does communications for an agency who can't really say everything because I have to consider a lot of, you know, political security considerations. And then also Karim can't go to his editor every day and say, I'm going to go spend a night in a refugee camp and write a story because
they're... I mean, just to add to that, when we spent that night at the refugee camp, like, the kids over there, you know, weren't asking us for, you know, can you please make sure that, like, we have, Pepsi or whatever. They asked us to, like, they told me, next time you come, can you bring us papers and pens and pencils so we can draw, because we don't have papers and pencils, you know, so, and I have, like, a notebook at home, which is just filled with, like, drawings, because... one of the kids, 7-year-old, just kept taking the notebook and, like, drawing because it was so, like, she really wanted to draw, you know, and she just couldn't because that's not what it's not what you think about, you know, like, they need food, they need water, they need electricity, but, you know, they actually also need, like, to self-actualize, like, you know, the whole Maslow's pyramid of needs thing.
Yes, hi, I'm
Tanya
from there. I work with the Dutch Association. In how you work as a journalist. What I'm interested in is you keep putting out these stories and you keep doing your job and you keep traveling the field, but what needs to be done to get the reporting of journalism on these issues to the next level? If you had all the opportunities to really be the journalist you want to be on this subject, then what would be the first thing you would do? How would you go about that?
Unlimited funds and.
What would be the story that you would tell then? Because now you're telling parts of a story, and what is the bigger story that needs to be told?
Yeah.
It's difficult. So your work is there, and your colleagues' work is there. It's fabulous. Anyone that goes on The Guardian or all the other people in that panel today, there's almost too much to read. Is it just that there is a limit, or is there, as you say, is there something that gave you 3 months to report on something, or is it simply that that's the limit of journalism, you do your job?
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the really depressing things about, like, the Syria crisis is that, you know, we've been writing about it for the last 5 years and nothing's happened. You know? It's still really awful, you know. And
that could be a reason to try and look at it from a different perspective. If nothing happens, maybe we should try and do it in another way.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what way. You're the expert. Yeah.
Far, far from it. I'm not sure that, like, the way that I propose is really going to necessarily be that effective for, like, you know, the attitudes of policymakers necessarily, but I think it would be more effective for the people actually affected by the crisis itself. So, one of the things I mentioned in the talk previously is this idea of the hero narrative. You know, it's... I grew up in the Middle East and in a very conservative household. One of the things that was a recurrent theme in me growing up was, you know, going to the mosque, learning about the Prophet, learning about this, you know, halo and mythology surrounding early Islam, right? and the emergence of Islam and you know into all the surrounding areas and how the message of God was spread, you know, all the heroics of the Prophet's companions and so on. And I think what is lacking in sort of in our societies today is the idea that you could be sort of a modern day hero. You know, there's nothing heroic about having a middle class existence. There's nothing heroic about going and standing in the grocery store for an hour, you know, to buy some cereal or, you know, peanut butter cups, you know. What I think that really feeds into the growth of these fundamentalist and fundamentalist groups is because people lose hope and because people really want to recreate that utopia that they think existed at one point in our history. And, you know, and so people who are displaced, people who face barrel bombs, you know, every day, people who face chemical weapons attacks, people who go through all of that, you know, it's only natural that they will become radicalized. You know, it's only natural that there's only a certain limit, you know, after so many of your children you've seen die in front of you, that you're not going to become, you know, a radical yourself. And really kind of emphasizing the heroes in this, you know, mass of refugees that seems so impersonal to everyone. I think telling their individual stories and telling how they're everyday heroes is actually a good way to inspire the people who are actually affected by the crisis itself, but not necessarily the policymakers who are going to, you know, make a difference ultimately if they, you know, decide to open the gates to, you know, allow refugees in. I mean, you know, Angela Merkel's, you know, about face on the whole refugee issue, you know, came a couple of days after she was, you know, doing a roundtable and this, you know, Syrian kid told her, like, I really don't want to go home. I really don't want to go back to Lebanon, you know. And a few days later, she, you know, said that we're going to suspend the Dublin agreement, you know, and we're going to open the door to, you know, so many hundreds of thousands of refugees. So I think, you know, it's like Clarissa in the previous session said, like, you know, don't be an idiot and think that your journalism is going to change the world. You know, but it might, you know, if it changes one mind, if it inspires, you know, one kid living in the slums in Beirut, you know, or it inspires, you know, a father who took his children to Europe and is trying to find a life for them, or a guy in, you know, under barrel bombs in Aleppo, you know, well, I think then, you know, I've at least done part of my job.
That's a good point when you talk about journalism trying to have an effect, but exactly on whom, you know, impacting on a politician is really quite a different narrative to trying to get attention and people are distracted by ordinary life. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are occasions when it does happen, but it's sort of like, you know, it's kind of a shot in the dark, like it just happens every now and then. I mean, you know, one example is like the Madaya story. So there was this, you know, this village in Syria that was besieged by the regime. And it's actually been besieged for like 6 months, you know, nobody really wrote about it. And, you know, and then we actually realized that the crisis had reached such a disproportionate level through our contacts in the town. And then, you know, we end up writing a story and I think we were actually probably the first to write about it, and then like in the next few hours, you know, people were like all the international news media started covering it, and the next day the Assad regime said that they would allow aid deliveries into the town, when, you know, possibly if there was no coverage of it at all, you know, this issue would have gone like completely unnoticed. And
yeah. It was a big story, but it didn't become a big story
probably
after 6 months.
Ten other the equivalent stories that could have happened.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's like
so many villages.
I mean, you know, Madaya is like 40,000 people, and there are by MSF's count, there's, you know, over a million besieged people in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's in the Yarmouk refugee camp, they've been under siege for 3 years. You know, these, you know, and we've written about it, but you know, there's not much that happened to lift the siege, so it's a very random. It's kind of like it's really hard to predict when it's going to happen. Yeah, yeah.
There's a question over there.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point about how much journalists and the media industry as a whole can affect change, and that a lot of, sometimes people expect journalists and the media to affect change, and it's not know, Karim, what you think the refugees want from you. How do they see you? You know, how are they using you? Are they conscious of that you might be able to do something? Do they consciously think, oh, I can, you know, this guy can give me a voice or whatever? And Joelle, how has your journey changed? Because it looks, it sounds, I haven't looked up your work history, but it sounds like you were on the ground and then you decided to go into comms and now you're studying journalism. That's quite an interesting sort of development. How did that happen?
I'll start, yeah. It's actually really interesting. I used to do refugee protection, and I used to work in UNHCR's detention legal unit. And I used to sit there for hours arguing with refugees about why they went in front of a camera and spoke to the media. And then I moved into communications, and then I was asking refugees to stand in front of a camera and say why we should be telling the world their story. This year is sort of a break for me to, beginning of the year I told you I want to learn how to think like a journalist because really...
Work with them more effectively.
Exactly. My work doesn't come across if people like Karim aren't committed to telling the story or don't get a green light from their editors to do a story. And really... Again, 4 or 5 years into a crisis, and I have really young experience with the field. I can't compare it to, you know, crises in Darfur or in other places around the world, but I can tell you, you become cynical in the sense that you start doubting really the effectiveness of the whole system, right? And then you realize, but there really isn't much that we can do. And for many people, it's just a job. For me, it's a little bit more. And you start focusing on the small, you know, day-to-day encounters with families and stories and cases that you can sort of help. I have a camera and I go to the field a lot. And one photo we took, remember this woman who used to tie. She used to put scarves around her two little boys' bellies when they sleep because they couldn't afford to have dinner, so the children wouldn't wake up in the middle of the night feeling pain. So we put this photo, and again, we have to make these editorial decisions as well, what photo to put, what caption to put, what part of the story to tell, and we start to act like journalists and think like journalists. And that one photo example brought in $60,000 dollars to help WFP feed, you know, over 2 million people in the region. But these are some of the examples of things that I have to think on the day-to-day basis and think, well, are they effective? And why did I choose this refugee? And am I really giving the refugee a voice? You know, when I put out the press release on, you know, WFP successfully delivering aid in an area inside Syria, is the displaced person or the, you know, person in need having a voice? All of those questions. And maybe Karim can move on to...
Yeah, I mean, you know, and refugees have become really cynical of, like, you know, they know you're going there and they know their situation might not change, you know, just because they gave you an interview, or at least their individual situation, you know. But it occasionally does, you know. When we do stories on, you know, winter conditions for refugees, people start donating clothes. You know, there are, like, these donation drives because people are aware, in Lebanon, for example, that it's a problem. So there was this huge donation drive where people, you know, went and, like, just gave a lot of their clothes, you know, over to refugees, you know, to survive winter. Same thing, you know, in terms of food and, you know, other health access issues. There was a story, I think, of, you know, two refugee children who died in Lebanon because of the snow, you know, like in the snow because it was so cold. So these stories do sometimes, you know, contribute to that. When we did the Maldives stories, a lot of people were asking us, you know, who do you know inside Syria that does delivery to besieged areas that we can donate to? You know, so there is, it does generate some interest. I'm not sure what, like, I could scientifically quantify, like, how much of it actually does end up going to the people who need it. But it definitely, you know, definitely does, especially the more shocking stories, you know, people can be quite desensitized. Yeah, I mean, you know, they obviously, like, some of them are actually, you know, who genuinely are in, you know, dire need of something. Like, they actually say that, you know, could you put us in touch with someone, you know, in the UN or in another agency who could help us with a particular issue? And, you know, if I do know someone, I do. You know, I give them their number or, you know, put them in touch or tell them that, you know, there's this case in this place, you know. And I know a lot of journalists who've, you know, fundraised to help individual families. I know the CNN correspondent, her name is Arwa Damon, she's quite famous. She set up an NGO in Lebanon called Inara, which specializes in fundraising for refugees who need life-saving surgeries. And they've helped, you know, dozens or hundreds of refugee kids, you know, do things like get prosthesis and things like that. We try and do that on a sort of an individual basis whenever the opportunity does present itself.
But blur the lines a bit between reporting and acting.
Yeah, but I don't care. You know, if I'm presented with an opportunity to help another human being, you know, I'm not going to stand there and watch them suffer without trying to help them. You know.
Actually, there goes my whole lecture on
objectivity. I think it's a good sort of like, you know, moral compass to realize you're human first and journalist second, you know. And if you do have the opportunity to help, you know, go ahead. Like, I don't think it, you know, I think it's important to be compassionate, you know, and I think that compassion and empathy really are important to making a good journalist. But don't promise them anything. You can't say, like, you're definitely now going to, you know, get some help because I wrote about you. You know, it's horrible to kind of, you know, increase expectations that way. Yeah.
Jamal, also.
I'm going to be the devil's advocate here and say not every journalist who comes to Lebanon or to Jordan or to Turkey or to Egypt or to Iraq or to cover the story, or not every cameraman and news crew that come, not all of them have the same... Yes, and ethics and value as Karim and all the other journalists we saw today. Some people just really want to come and tell the story. And I can tell you firsthand that many, many refugees right now, they will get irritated and agitated if they see a camera and a crew coming into a camp because they're really fed up and they don't want to say the story anymore because nothing happens. And for them, you come in and out, and they feel like this as well, vis-a-vis humanitarian and aid workers who come in and out and don't do anything, and there are many of them out there, and many journalists who do the same, and so they feel like, okay, the world has abandoned us, no one cares, they're coming to do their job, and they're just fed up, and they will get sometimes, not all of them, they will get a tiny bit hostile, because they're just really fed up, and I personally don't... give journalists, you know, refugee numbers or contacts unless I really trust that this journalist is going to really very carefully tackle the story and will follow up with the family and will come out with something that could help them in some way. If not, just tell the story as best as he or she could. And this is what I tell refugees. Nothing will come out of you speaking to this journalist, but you need to understand that I know what's going on, you know, here, and you know, and the journalist might know, but many, many people out there don't, and this is your chance to say what you do want to say. And often, you know, the sound bites are cut, and what they really want to say is not included, but we still try to do the best we can, like, I guess.
I'm going to stop it there. It's a bunch of time. I just want to say it's been a real joy and a privilege to be working with Joelle on this. Also to have Karim part of this and to come over to London and be part of this conference and this film. And I think that was it's really worked for me. We've had a really good discussion, perhaps part stimulated by that film, and I hope that it continues to have that effect. So thanks very much, everyone, for coming to this session. Enjoy your lunch and well done, guys.